And good morning. Welcome to the morning show here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm today's host, Chris Bessler, and we have a good show for you today. Today, we're talking with Dr. Hans Hurt. He is an emergency physician at Bonner General Health, and we're going to be talking about the emergency department and things that are going on there. Dr. Hans, thank you for coming in to talk with us.
Yeah, good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, we're going to dive into that in just a moment, but first, let's take a look at a few of the things going on around town, starting with the weather. And actually, it's kind of rainy out there, and unfortunately, that's what we're seeing for the next 5 days here. The highs are going to be actually pushing 50 degrees today, and again, on Thursday and Friday, the highs are predicted to be 48 and 46 degrees. That's same right in through Saturday and Sunday. The lows are only going to be getting down to the mid-30s. Actually, the lows, 37, 40. Hans, you were saying that you are a skier. How do you greet this news?
One day at a time.
Yeah, hope for a change in the weather. I just took a look at the mountain condition report up on Schweitzer, and it is raining there right now. But there is still skiing to be had. They're maintaining the one run that they have open down Midway. So it would be nice if things would at least get colder up there. On the mountain forecast, so today it's at a high of 40 there right now. They see a low of only 37. And 36 is the high for tomorrow, low of 31. Friday, a high of 35, low of 35. So we are stuck in an atmospheric river that's rather warm, unfortunately. But as for things that are going on around town, of course, there's a ton of stuff going on around town. There's a bunch of Christmas programs happening. And let me pull that up here on my screen so I can tell you exactly what those are. this Friday is Sandpoint Ladies Night. It's a big shopping and hangout together with your friends night where you can cruise around the various stores downtown, and they'll have some festive sips, special deals, and holiday cheer. I think it starts off at Barrel 33. It tours around town. It ends up at the Pondre Winery. And also on Friday, the Nutcracker is going to be playing at the Panda Theater. And it's actually going to be on Friday, one show on Friday, and then two shows on Saturday. That's being put on by Allegra Dance Studio. Also on Saturday, it's the Sandpoint Waldorf Winter Fair and Children's Festival. And then also on Saturday is Sandpoint SantaCon. And that's a day to get dressed up like Santa, get together with others. It starts at the Matchwood Brewing Company. And they're going to be raising money this year for the Schweitzer Avalanche Dogs program. So do you have a Santa getup, Hans?
I'll have to start looking for one. I don't have one yet.
Yeah, I don't have one either, but it sounds like that would be a lot of fun. You can get details on these events, but there's a ton of other things going on around town. There's a lot of live music, and there's a different Christmas programs happening. If you go to our website, krfy.org, and you click on the community calendars. And with that, let's get into today's program. Again, we have with us Dr. Hans Hurt. He's an emergency physician at Bonner General Health. And we want to focus in on Bonner General's emergency department, and particularly a state program. It's called the Idaho Time Sensitive Emergency System that was designed to help meet emergency health needs for the top three preventable causes of death, which are, if you give them, trauma, stroke, and heart attack. Hans, do you like to go by Dr. Hurt, or is Hans okay? What do you prefer?
Yeah, Chris, Hans is fine. Okay. If you'd like saying Dr. Hurt, go ahead and say that too.
Okay, or Dr. Hans. You get that too, I'm sure. Okay. Let's start out by learning a little bit more about your story. Why don't you tell us about your journey in the medical field and how you wound up in Sandpoint?
Yeah, I ended up going into medicine a little later than some, kind of my late 20s. Yeah, and I ended up going through the University of Washington program, the WAMI program. So that I was based out of Montana at that point and did some rotations kind of up in this area over in Libby, Montana. So I got familiar with this part of the Northwest that way. And with the WAMI program, bounced around a bit from Montana to Boise to Seattle. And then trained down in Albuquerque, New Mexico for my residency program.
Tell us what the WAMI program is.
Yeah, so the WAMI program is a co-op of some of the states up here in the Pacific Northwest because the populations are smaller, so they're not really the population density to have a medical school within each state just because of the cost of that and the everything. So they coordinated with the University of Washington, Montana did, Idaho, Wyoming, Alaska, kind of all came together. And that's what the WAMI program.
So they basically give you kind of an in-state or a discounted tuition.
Yeah. So you get in-state tuition. Mm-hmm. And when I went through the program back in 2009, the first year was done in-state for each of the states. And then the second year was done in Seattle. And then the years 3 and 4 were done kind of back out throughout the different states. And they have a lot of different rural clerkships. We have some here in town. I know the Family Health Center does some. And then there's rotations that go through the hospital as well. So it's a really great program that it kind of combines a central curriculum that really is cutting edge with the University of Washington and all the professors there. But then it's facilitated by a lot of places out at the state level. Mm-hmm. Includes all these rural clerkships where there's a lot of great doctors and way more hands-on than you get in some other medical school. So it's a great program, and the states help fund it, and it continues to develop. And I think now there's more of the education is done in the individual states, and there's less that happens necessarily with all of the students in Seattle all at the same time, just because they've increased the numbers to kind of meet demand, and the University of Washington just, I don't think it had classrooms that were quite big enough for all of those bring everybody in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they're from around the entire region, really.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you'll meet, you know, medical students that are from Alaska that are rotating through Montana or Idaho. And yeah, gets people going around and really exposes them to some great rural communities and helps bring doctors back to the local area. So,
mm-hmm. Well, important program for these states that have a lot of rural areas like ours, Idaho. So continue on with your journey.
Yeah. So then I ended up down in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for my EM residency program, emergency medicine, down there at the University of New Mexico. That was a great program, combined also some different rural clerkships and such up in Taos, New Mexico. And there's some opportunities to work up in Raton, New Mexico, too. Also some smaller hospitals that gave me good exposure that way. And I stayed on as faculty for an additional 2 years. And then it was time for us to kind of move back to the Pacific Northwest, where we had some more snow and colder temps and more water. We kind of ended up finding Sandpoint after we pulled out an atlas and started circling smaller towns and ski hills and water. Mm-hmm. Sandpoint stuck out as being a great one. Then I remembered I had a relative that kind of lived up in this area for a long time and got in touch with them and came up and visited, and we fell in love with the town and the area and moved up in 2018.
Okay. So you've been here for, that's going on 8 years, must be.
Yeah. Time's flying by. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so did you come to, did you start at Bonner General?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. I was able to get on with the group there. And I've been with that same group since then, and kind of taken on different roles within the group, from being one of the, one of the partners to now doing more of the administrative sides of the group as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, tell us, how does the emergency department fit in with the services that Bonner General Health provides?
Yeah. So the emergency department, right, we don't make appointments, and we're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year long. So we are there, and we're kind of that entrance for anything that pops up that's an emergency or is bothering somebody kind of in that immediate time where they don't have the ability to make an appointment or it's something they need to get addressed right away. And so we see everybody who comes in with, whether it's broken bones or heart attacks or belly pains, things like that. So we see them and then try and figure out what's going on and get them tied in with the system, whether they need a surgery or whether they need to get transferred and treated for something else, or if it's something we can send them home with and have them coordinate some close follow-up.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that, though, the typical idea of the emergency room is somebody that has an accident or something traumatic happens to them. But it sounds like you also get people that may have more chronic issues but don't have a health provider lined up.
Yeah, a lot of it just kind of depends what that person feels like is an emergency for them and what they're worried about. So that's a lot of times it is accidents, whether somebody's up skiing and falls and breaks a leg or hits their head or they fall off a ladder. Or, you know, if somebody starts getting sick and is short of breath, we see kind of a wide range of things that way. But then there's the side too, where sometimes people don't have great access with a primary care provider and something's been bugging them for a few weeks or a few months even, and for different reasons, something is bothering them a little bit more that day and they really want to come in and get it checked out. So we see everything you can think of.
You may not have this information at hand, but how does that break down? Like, higher percentage of people with broken legs come in, or is it just spread across that spectrum?
That is a great question. And I don't know if I have all of those numbers and how it plays in with kind of our total population. You know, some of our more common complaints are like abdominal pain, chest pain, shortness of breath. And then we'll see kind of different extremity injuries is a good portion as well. That I'd have a hard time putting an exact percentage on it, I think.
Are the people that come into the emergency room, they're in pain often, I assume?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are pain.
A couple of times I've been there, that was the case.
Yep, usually that's kind of the main issue. If people are feeling good, then they'll just wait it out. But if they're having pain, that's usually what tips them over and brings them in.
Yeah, okay. So just looking at the information online, it looks like you're classified as pediatric capable. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Yeah, I want to say it's a more recent state designation that we've done different training. We have different equipment to make sure that we can handle pediatrics well. So that means that we have the equipment for intubating pediatrics and also the different equipment that's more ped specific, and as well as some training for the nurses to make sure that everybody is on board to give a good high level of care for that patient group.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What other kinds of medical professionals are involved in the emergency department?
Yeah, so we have a great staff of nurses and also some techs that help keep the patients moving through and that they're well taken care of. And then we do a lot of consults with the general surgery group here in town, as well as the orthopedics, because a lot of people come in with either appendicitis or bowel obstructions, gallbladder problems. And then there's also all the broken bones that we need to talk to the orthopedist about and coordinate follow-up with them. So those are kind of the main groups that we have here now.
How many doctors are involved in total?
So there's on our staff for the emergency department doctors, we have 10 of us on the books. And then there's the general surgery group is 3. And I believe we have 6 or 7 orthopedists in town. So there's right around 20 doctors that end up doing things throughout the emergency department regularly.
But you have to be staffed 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the 10 of us that are the emergency department doctors, we cover the emergency department 24 hours a day. And generally now our volumes have gotten busy enough where we do it in 3 different shifts just to kind of keep our attention span and keep us fresh.
Mm-hmm. Do we get a big percentage of people that come in at night? The people that go to the emergency room seems like they're probably happening typically off hours.
Yeah, but still we see probably about 85% of our volume from 7 in the morning to 11 at night. And then we see 10 to 15% from 11 at night to 7 in the morning. So we're still a more rural area where most people sleep at night.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Okay, well... Tell us a little bit more about what the Idaho time-sensitive emergency system is.
Yeah, so this is a state-organized department that coordinates with all the different hospitals throughout the state, at least those that enroll kind of in some of the programs, but they work with pretty much all of the hospitals, targeting areas of trauma, stroke, and what we call STEMIs, or the really acute heart attacks that need to get to the cath lab quickly. And they targeted those areas because those areas have really high kind of mortality rates, where that's, you know, a large cause of death. And with those three areas, those are also areas where if we intervene rapidly and really identify the causes, then we can really affect the outcomes and help people a lot and hopefully get them home safely or get them home in better shape eventually. And since I've been on with Bonner General, I took over helping with the trauma, must be about 5 years ago, and took over for the stroke and STEMI shortly thereafter as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the state goes out to all the different hospitals that are involved in this, and then they do credentialing for each of those areas every 3 years. So they do a lot of chart reviews and look throughout the facility about the equipment they have. And then a lot of time stuff that breaks down patient visits about how long they took them before they got their first EKG or their first head CT, and then how long it took for decisions to be made and the patient be transferred and the medications they got. So it's a really close oversight looking at the chart reviews to find areas that we can improve timing, improve communication, and improve those patient outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's break down these areas a little bit. You provide some notes, thank you, on traumas. So what's an MVC injury?
Yeah, so an MVC is one of the main causes for what we see for injuries and fatalities, and that's a motor vehicle collision. Sometimes you also see it abbreviated as MVA, motor vehicle accident. And those, right now, that's our kind of leading cause of injury and death that we have in our trauma department. So some of that will be from hitting animals out in the road. A large percentage, when we look statewide for what causes motor vehicle accidents, we'll see 36% of those are related with drivers that are impaired, either intoxicated or on another substance. And we may kind of think it's a standard out there too that everybody always wears a seatbelt, but still 40% of those deaths that happen from motor vehicle accidents aren't wearing seatbelts. So that's a really easy area to remind everybody out there that please put your seatbelt on, because it will save your life and it will reduce your injuries.
Yeah, don't become part of the 40% statistic.
Yeah.
That's a pretty simple thing to do.
It is.
Stick your seatbelt on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're definitely seeing reduced injuries with the fancier airbags that are out there, the side airbags and the curtain airbags. So those make a huge difference too. So if you are looking for a new car, you know, that difference of having one with those good airbags.
Yeah. It's something important that you don't think about until you actually need it, right? The airbags, they're amazing technology, to tell you truth. Having come up in the time when seatbelts were not even standard equipment in cars, I can say that there were some pretty gruesome things that happened when I was a little kid in terms of, or growing up in high school and seeing, hearing some of the wrecks at some of my high school compadres had at that time. So anyway, seatbelts important. So a new area of trauma you mentioned is e-bikes.
Yeah, if you look around town, you'll see these getting used a lot, which definitely can help reduce traffic. Parking is easier. There's a lot of benefits for them, just to help decongest some areas of town. But they can go fast, right? They do have an electric motor in there, and you know they're supposed to be regulated at 20 or 25 miles an hour, but there's certainly ways to bypass that. And even 20 miles an hour is fast on a bike in town.
Yeah, you get injuries if you wreck at 20 or 25 miles an hour.
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a fair amount of head injuries from these, partly because there's more of them out there, and partly because people are going faster. And it's also probably a different population that's now on bikes, you know, people that maybe didn't use to bike before, but now it's a little easier to do. So they're getting out there and using those, which is, I think, a great thing overall. We're only seeing about 30% of those people wearing helmets. So that's also an easy thing to do. It's like a seatbelt, something that's accessible and should be easy to access. Especially when we see a lot of head injuries in that group. So please put a helmet on every time you get on that bike and just make it part of the routine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you are on an e-bike, you got to obey the rules of the road, and you have to know that you're not very visible to other vehicles. In these wrecks, you may not have this broken down, but is it, who's usually at fault when you have somebody coming in from an e-bike wreck? Is it the e-bike rider's carelessness, or is it, or were they just not seen by another vehicle and got nailed?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't necessarily have who's considered at fault for a lot of the accidents. There's also the aspect too that sometimes the e-bike driver is impaired too, mm-hmm. just like in motor vehicle accidents, that mm-hmm. still plays in a part there. So, regardless of who's at fault, the more that you can be visible on an e-bike, which, especially if you're in town wearing a brighter jacket so that you're visible and having lights on, if it's at dusk or if it's at dark, just to be visible will help you see so you don't wreck yourself and help others see you so they don't run into you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's no contest if you're in a wreck with a vehicle. The vehicle's going to win every time.
Indeed.
So also in the trauma department are falls, and that's something that affects mostly older people.
Yeah. That's just, I think, because of numbers and how our population is just changing, we're seeing that continue to increase. And that's actually our second kind of highest cause of trauma and fatalities that we see, is that people over the age of 65 having falls. And, a common thing is that a hip can get broken, or there can be some rib fractures or even head injuries. We also see a lot of people over that age who end up on blood thinners for whether it's atrial fibrillation or other reasons with, treating blood clots. But that puts them at increased risk for head injuries and head bleeds. So different things too with falls is that realizing that if you don't use it, you start to lose it when it comes to strength and balance and things like that. So it really is important to stay active, whether it's going out for walks daily or going to the gym or doing different social activities that keep you active. So anything along those lines will hopefully help lower your individual risk for having falls later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a word out to older folks is stay active.
That's right. Stay out on those skis as long as you can.
That's right. Yeah, I have a friend that's verging on 80, and he's still up there snowboarding. So he's my model for maintaining health later in life, is staying active.
So, yeah, one of my favorite patients, there's a nice 92-year-old gentleman who is went for a regular run around town, and one day he tripped on something and fell forwards and scraped up his face. And then he asked me, he's like, "Doc, does this mean I should stop running?" I was like, "No, certainly not. You need to keep moving, keep using it, and stay strong."
Yeah, 92, that's kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
So, okay, so those are some of the main traumas that you see in the emergency room. What about one of the other large categories, and that's strokes?
Yeah, so strokes is an area where time is really important. So when you think about some of those symptoms for a stroke with that kind of the acronym BFAST, so problems with balance or coordination, eyes freeze or loss of vision or changes of vision, facial asymmetry or facial droop, and then arm weakness or weakness in your legs, problems with speech. Really think that and remember that time is important. Because we have a narrow window of time to really have some of our medications work for that. There's a medication out there called thrombolytics. The one we currently use is TNK, which is targeted to help break down clots that form strokes. So, since we have a population that's very healthy in the number of years they have up here, with more years of wisdom, then we tend to see more strokes in some places for our overall population. And one thing that can be tricky is just if people try and wait it out at home, then they're out of that 3 to 4.5 hour time window where we can use those thrombolytics. So it limits some of the interventions we can do. But when people first come in, we're really kind of under a time crunch to get them to the CT scanner and then assess if they'd benefit from it, make sure they don't have a bleed going on that would mean we can't use it, and then coordinating those medications and transfer. So Time is important.
So the conditions that you mentioned that say loss of vision or a facial droop or arm weakness, how does somebody self-identify that really? how do you know that you're having a stroke? Because I guess a lot of people have really tiny mini strokes and they don't even really know about it necessarily.
Yeah, so that could be tricky for people to self-identify it. Sometimes one that we see a lot is people will get up in the middle of the night, and call those either wake-up strokes, whether it's in the morning or in the middle of the night, and they'll try and walk to go to the bathroom, and they're limping or they're off balance, or they maybe they turn on the light and they see in the mirror that their part of their face isn't really working right, or their arm or leg just isn't as strong as it should be. So sometimes people can self-identify. Sometimes it's other people that are sitting with them and look over and hear their speech change a little bit or see their face not look the same. So those are all things where if you notice any of those symptoms, you know, we have a great EMS system up here that can get to your home quickly and help get you transported in to get evaluated.
I could assume this is an older age group that tends to be affected by strokes.
Yeah, generally the majority are going to be also kind of over that age of 65. But we do see some strokes that happen even in people down into their 30s. They're less common, but they can happen at any age, just with different risk factors for, either communication between the right and left side of the heart or carotid dissections, things like that can happen at any age.
What are some lifestyle, like for falls and maintaining your balance, staying active is a lifestyle choice you can make. What are some lifestyle choices that people make that reduce the chance of getting a stroke?
Yeah, so some of the big risks out there for, same with heart attacks and for strokes, the one that we still see as the highest contributor is smoking. That's really hard on your blood vessels and plays in for both of those. Diet always comes in. How your blood pressure is also important. So if you can maintain a healthy diet and do things to lower your blood pressure as far as losing weight and staying active, those are things that also reduce your risk for stroke and your risk for heart attack.
Mm-hmm. Blood pressure, a lot of people tend to get higher blood pressure as they age. How often should older folks, people in their 60s or 70s, be checking their blood pressure?
So that is a great question. That's a kind of a topic for discussion with among some doctors. But blood pressure is something that is really important when we look at months to years to decades. When we look at blood pressure day to day, it's going to fluctuate a lot. If you stub your toe and break your toe every time you step on it, that causes pain and that's going to make your blood pressure go up. If you're stressed about different things, as far as you have family visiting or you have to pay some bills, or you're running around or doing a construction project, stress can make blood pressure go up too. So there's going to be a lot of fluctuations when it's day to day. But blood pressure is something that is important to follow up with your primary care doctor to make sure that when you look at the trend over months to years to decades, that it's staying in control that way. Mm-hmm. So how often should an individual check it? That I think is something where it's probably more, you know, if people check it in once a week or a month and just kind of write down the numbers so that they can follow that up with their primary care doctor. That's a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people that if they check their blood pressure every day, they're going to see a lot of that variation. And if your blood pressure is high and you're worried about it, it only does one thing, and that it goes up higher.
It makes more blood pressure.
Yeah. That's where sometimes checking it less will help people relax. So it's not something to ignore totally, but it's not something to necessarily stress about hour to hour or day to day.
Okay, so the third kind of big area in the time-sensitive emergencies is STEMI. It's STEMI. That's an acronym, our heart attacks. What does STEMI stand for?
So in... That's a ST elevation myocardial infarction. And that has to do when we look at the electricity of the heart on an EKG and an electrocardiogram. There's different names for all those little different sections of the squiggle on the paper. And the ST section is kind of the last section of the waves of the electricity of the heart. And when that's elevated, that tells us that part of the perfusion and the electrical repolarization of the heart is off. And that's where that was found to correlate with blocked arteries when they looked at that. So those are the types of heart attacks that are felt to be the most important ones to treat really quickly. Because when that artery is blocked, it causes those changes. And then that muscle tissue, the heart, starts to die. We have kind of a limited time window to get that heart tissue reperfused, to get the blood flowing again so that people can recover and still have a good, strong heart.
Mm-hmm. So heart attacks are something that's going to be like a sign, oh, there's massive heart attacks and you just basically drop dead. But again, that's on a scale, right? People have mild heart attacks.
Yeah, there is. There is a wide range. And that's what makes heart attacks really tricky sometimes. Some people will have the classic symptoms of crushing chest pain that radiates up to their jaw, to the arm, and they get nauseous and sweats. And that's really typical that way. But then sometimes we'll have elderly females with just really mild symptoms, and they'll feel like they maybe have a little mild bronchitis or chest pressure, and they won't have the same symptoms, but they'll have similar stuff going on with their heart. So it's a wide range of symptoms that people can have, from those really classic signs to ones that can be a little more vague and subtle. Mm-hmm.
Again, I assume age is part of the calculus here. Older people are more prone to have a heart attack. How about gender?
Yeah, generally we think of males at a higher risk for heart attacks, but some of that too is just they would generally have more of the classic symptoms. So I think as we catch more and more heart attacks with kind of understanding more of the subtle symptoms, I think then it starts to balance out a little bit more between males and females.
Mm-hmm. And again, same question here as with these other bigger areas. What are lifestyle choices that help with heart health?
Yeah, so kind of like we talked about in a stroke, really the biggest one and easiest one is nicotine use and smoking. If you can take that out of your life, then you reduce your risk there a lot. So being healthy and choosing not to smoke is a big part of it. And then exercise, diet and exercise play in. People who have more weight or are obese are going to have higher risks as well. So staying active, eating healthy, choosing not to smoke, less alcohol consumption is also overall beneficial for heart health. Those are some of the main easy targets.
One thing I've noticed a little bit more now, say in gyms and so on, there are these little defibrillator units. Is that happening more kind of around public spaces?
Yeah, there's so we refer to those kind of as the AEDs, automated defibrillators, that are out there in a lot of different public places, whether it's gyms or sports stadiums. The ski hill up at Schweitzer, they have them staged in a few spots as well, because there's some different types of heart attacks that will cause your heart to go into an abnormal rhythm. And if that's treated really quickly and people are given a shock to bring them back into appropriate rhythm, then they'll do a lot better. Yeah.
So if having almost no knowledge about these sort of things, and I saw somebody that I recognized, this person is having a heart attack, mm-hmm. and one of those units are available, how do you put the pieces together as just a member of the general public? Should you try to use one of those defib units?
The training for those ends up being really simple. And most of those ones that you see out there are made for the general public to use. And you basically open it up, turn it on, and it will walk you through step by step how to place the pads on. And then it'll analyze and decide whether or not to shock. Mm-hmm. So it's something that, if somebody collapses in front of you and becomes unresponsive, that would be a really kind of safe thing to put on them and work through.
So that's a good thing for the general public to at least be aware of, you know, if they're, especially mm-hmm. in their places, like you mentioned, you know, gyms or places where people are really active, because that seems to be a place where a larger event like a heart attack might happen.
Yeah, certainly. And there are a number, I think there's a couple different apps out there too that you can get on your phone that'll show the locations for different AEDs.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So if that's something that you want to go on and check out a YouTube about how to use them and then kind of understand them a little bit, then you could also download that app on your phone to be aware of where they are if you're in one of those situations.
Well, that raises an interesting question. How engaged should people be with understanding basic first aid?
You know, basic first aid is something that I think is really important. Some of the great classes out there, whether you do just a first aid class or whether you do like a wilderness first responder course, those bring in a lot of information that's good to understand. Simple things from ankle sprains and breaks to, you know, different symptoms like chest pain or shortness of breath, and some of the ways that you can treat some of those things at home or when really it's important to head into the emergency department right away. So I'd encourage everybody to do some aspect of first aid or a wilderness first responder course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you were out in public and somebody collapsed in front of you or somebody was in an accident, what would be the things that you would check for? You know, help me be on the way. The ambulance may be coming, but what are some of the things you would check for, let's say in an accident? If you were had an unresponsive person, and it seems to me that what I recall from a long time ago when I took a first aid class was first thing to look for is actually potential blood, because you could bleed out in a matter of minutes, and then after that it's are they breathing, and I don't know, walk us through what you would look for if you saw a person that had been in an accident and was unconscious.
Yeah, some of it would vary a little bit, whether if it was a car accident versus if somebody just collapsed. But usually the first thing is just to see if they're awake. Like if they can talk to you, that means that they're breathing usually and their work can control their airway and that their level of mentation is at a good spot. So try to just see if somebody can respond. If somebody can't respond, then kind of checking to see if they're breathing or if there's something stuck in their mouth is an important thing, to try and position them where that where they'd be able to breathe easier, or maybe doing a jaw thrust just to help open up their airway. And then at kind of that same time, right after, checking to see if they have a heartbeat, if they have a pulse. And then that's where if somebody isn't breathing and doesn't have a pulse, that's when we'd begin kind of that basic life support with CPR. So that's where a first aid class or a basic BLS, kind of basic life support class for CPR would be good baseline knowledge for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does BGH offer those kind of classes, or how would somebody...
BGH does offer some BLS classes and ACLS classes and other places around. There's some wilderness first responder courses that also tie in a lot of that information and also give some great information for if you're out hiking, what to do if you have different things happen then, since we have a lot of active outdoors people here with hunters and hikers and bikers and things that way. That wilderness first responder course would give a little more information for not only what you'd see with somebody who collapses down and needs help, but also for somebody who gets injured when they're out being active. So there's a couple of different wilderness medicine places in town that you could reach out to. Longleaf Wilderness Medicine is one that does some number of courses. And I believe there's a few other programs around as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, running through my list of questions here, but let's circle back on the Idaho Time Sensitive Emergency System that Bonner General Health is part of. Did Bonner General have to shape up its services differently to be part of that statewide system?
Yeah, to be part of that statewide system. So Bonner General was already involved in the time sensitive emergency stuff before I came on. So I don't know what they had to do when they initially started the program, but almost every year, it seems, we're recertifying in one of the areas. So with that, we're doing chart reviews and looking at different patients and looking at a lot of time averages. So, and we've had to change things since I've been on, because we try and streamline things to shave off 5 minutes here, 2-3 minutes there, what we can do to either get medications on board faster, to get people over to CT faster, to get EKGs done faster, to transport them out of the hospital faster. So that every time we go through one of those reviews, we find little things that we can work on and continue to change. So that's an important part of the process, is really seeing, okay, what else can we continue to work on?
Yeah. So the key words here are time sensitive emergency, because acting fast can make a big difference in these kinds of events. Does Bonner General coordinate with other entities as part of this program?
Yeah, big groups that we work with. We work with Bonner County EMS a lot. They've been great in their response for getting to the hospital and helping us transport patients. It really is amazing when we look at our times for the heart attacks and the STEMIs. So they really help facilitate quick transfers down to Kootenay, and we work closely with Kootenay and get feedback on the patients that we send down there. Because they are part of the same system with the TSC in the state, and part of what they need to do is like give us feedback about how times were and things that we can improve on, since they're one of our main transfer center. We work closely with them. We have monthly meetings with them and quarterly meetings to kind of get feedback about those things. So Bonner County EMS, Kootenay Medical Center, and then for strokes, we also work closely with Sacred Heart, because they're the local center that does intervention up into the arteries of the brain to help remove clots up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in everybody's thoughts about what type of health services we should have in our town, having an emergency room that can deal with these time-sensitive health emergencies has got to be right there at the top. What else, Dr. Hans Hurt, emergency physician at Bonner General Health, what else do you want to tell us about the program as we're wrapping up here?
Just that, you know, Bonner General has worked really hard over the years, and we have some great times to, you know, great times overall on a lot of these areas. We get the kind of numbers for us and some of the other regional hospitals that are smaller like us, and we're really fortunate to have a facility that's supported well by the community and the administration, to have CT techs there 24 hours a day so that we can get people to those CT scanners fast, and a great EMS service here in town too to get people transferred south. So it's a program I'm really proud to be part of and have, you know, continued quality improvement and really, you know, shave seconds here and there where we can. So it's a good program and a great hospital to be part of.
Well, Dr. Hans Hurt, emergency physician at Bonner General Health, I want to say for the community, thanks. We appreciate what the health providers do in this community. I mean, almost literally couldn't live without you.
Yeah, you're welcome, Chris. Thanks for having us on.
Okay. And we're going to go to a musical break here. Dr. Hans and I were just talking beforehand about the fact we're lacking some snow. So here's Bing Crosby with White Christmas. We're going to put that on for a few minutes, and I'll be back to wrap up.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. A white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your day